Today on CityCast Houston, what lessons were learned about the city from Tuesday's primaries, and what races are about to get heated as we gear up for November's election? Plus, there's major drama brewing with the Bush Airport Terminal B project, and could Westheimer get a bit safer? Houston Landing reporter Tim Carlin and Pulitzer Prize finalist Evan Mintz join me to recap a busy week in H-Town. It's Friday, March 8th. I'm Raheel Ramzanali, and here's what Houston's talking about. Tim, Evan, good morning. How's everybody doing?
Doing great.
Good morning. I'm good. Glad to be here.
All right, we published our March guide yesterday, so I need to get y'all's best thing to do in March. What's something you have to do in Houston in March? Evan, kick it off.
Around the spring equinox and the fall equinox, best weather. Best weather. Whenever we are changing our clocks, like springing forward and falling back, those are like the best days of the year. I can't wait till that first day after we go to daylight savings time or move away from it. I always forget what it is. But when you get that like extra hour of sun in the evening, but like it's still kind of cool out, like that is the best day of the year. Just do something outside.
For sure. I think for me, as a newer Houstonian, I would say going to the rodeo. I'm going for the first time this weekend, and I'm very excited. I have my cowboy boots at the ready.
Nice. That's going to be a lot of fun. Yeah, that extra hour, Evan, is the best. Oh my gosh. Sunday, I can't wait. Things just get back to normal, and it feels nice. It's more light. It's cool. Just be outside. Enjoy it when we have this perfect window of weather. All right. Biggest news of the week. Let's talk about the primaries, because there is a lot to unpack. So I'm just going to open it up. Tim, why don't you get us going? And we'll just go back and forth, because there's so many stories to talk about, so many different angles. What's your first one, Tim?
For sure. Definitely a very, very interesting primary election, I think. For me, what I wanted to bring to the table was Sheila Jackson Lee versus Amanda Edwards, kind of this very interesting primary, right? I think, you know, Sheila Jackson Lee is coming off of a pretty bruising defeat in the mayoral election. And there were a lot of conversations. I think the narrative was, you know, could this be the congresswoman's toughest challenge yet? You know, polling put them within 5 points of one another from the hobby school. And I think, all eyes were kind of on this race, right? It was kind of like a reputation rebuild or a reputation killer for Sheila Jackson Lee. And, you know, she kind of really just swatted away Amanda Edwards. You know, I hate to say it, I think the actual election results prove that this maybe wasn't as big of a primary challenge as maybe some folks thought it could be.
I was shocked to see Sheila Jackson Lee run away with it so easily. You know, she didn't have the money. She didn't seem to have the juice after that mayoral campaign. The poll showed it was close. And then in the end, I just don't underestimate Sheila Jackson Lee. Like, there are little old ladies out there who love her, and they turn out.
Mm-hmm.
And those little old ladies are really what matter here, right? That big brand, that established brand, is still holding a lot of power. And I think everyone was shocked by that because of everything y'all just mentioned. But it really felt like this was going to be the year where the younger former intern was going to get the job done and all that. But no. Not really. Sheila Jackson Lee is still here.
Now, lesson learned, if you want to take someone down, you've got to do attack ads. I really think so.
What other things stood out to you, Evan?
Well, the DA's race, like way up there. Rarely do you see an incumbent lose like this so brazenly, like 75% to 25%. Kim Ogg lost to Sean Tier. And already Republicans are trying to go after Tier to make it look like this was some progressive taking down a conservative. But Tier is a lifelong prosecutor. Like, that's who he is. And so I just think that Republicans are going to try to throw some attacks at him. And they're going to realize that this guy's pretty boring and that Kim Ogg was unpopular, not because she was conservative, but she was kind of a jerk to her base. She picked a lot of fights she didn't need to pick. And if you go through a record, she was losing a lot of felony cases. Her office was losing some high-level felony cases that you don't want prosecutors to lose. And, you know, in that attempt to be so tough on everything and treat every case like the worst case, you're not able to allocate the resources to those real, violent, high-risk cases. And that's what Sean Tier has talked about.
So, Evan, was this shocking? Because the entire party was already kind of condemning, and they officially did condemn Kim Ogg, right? So we knew there would be no support there. And I think for most voters, the actual cases, they really don't get into the weeds too much. But just the perception was like, yeah, there's no way she's going to get the nomination from the Democratic Party or win it through the votes. So was it that big of a shock?
I mean, I thought it would have been more of a shock were it not for the polling showing that she was just losing by a huge amount. Mm-hmm. But activists and young people in parties can make a lot of noise and do a lot of things. It really falls down to those reliable older voters who don't necessarily follow that stuff and like to go for incumbents. And you know, that's apparently not what happened here. You know, apparently the Democratic core just really didn't like her. You know, at the same time, you can look at some of these down ballot races, these judicial races, where incumbents lost in very bizarre ways. You know, Robert Schaefer, who'd been praised as an excellent civil court judge for a long time, had an excellent tenure as administrative judge, he lost his primary. Mike Engelhardt, too, lost his. And I think what you're seeing in a lot of those down ballot races is older white men just don't have the core support from the Democratic Party anymore. And I think that you have candidates who are qualified on their own, recognizing that if you are Black, if you are a woman, you have an opportunity to get in ways that didn't exist before.
I think there's an interesting conversation about judgeships statewide. I mean, last fall, if we think about the amendments to the state constitution, the only ballot amendment that failed was a push to increase the age of state judges. So I think there's an interesting kind of conversation going on about age and politics, especially maybe across the state, but also probably I think across the country as well.
No, I think that's a really good point. At a time we've got some old dudes running for president, if you have the opportunity to get young people in down ballot, folks are taking it. And, you know, we're seeing that fight, I think, in the SD15 primary. That's another big one to replace Senator Whitmire in the Senate. You're having a runoff between Jarvis Johnson, who's a state rep who got in with 40% of the vote, and Molly Cook, who's a young queer woman who has been out there as an activist for a long time, and she's making a shot at this. She got 20%. You know, it's really tough to come back from second place in a primary for the runoff, but we'll see what happens.
And by the way, the runoff is going to be on May 28th. Okay, other stories from the election on Tuesday. What did you guys think of the turnout? Because about 164,000 Harris County voters, or about 6% of the registered voters, cast their ballot on Tuesday. And this was super, super low. It felt like there was no excitement in this primary Tuesday. It just felt dead. We kind of knew it was going to be the case looking at the early voting returns. What did y'all think about the excitement for this week?
You know, presidential elections are what drive people. We didn't have a big primary on the Democratic side or the Republican side. Statewide, you saw a lot of Republican energy because you had outside challengers against Republican incumbents who either voted to impeach Ken Paxton or opposed the school voucher plan. And so they had folks coming for them. And so that really got some energy in those races. On the Democratic side, a little bit less so. You know, you don't expect people to turn out if there's not a thing that really gets them excited.
Yeah, I'll give a quick shout out to my colleague, Paul Cobbler. He wrote a story yesterday. He said revenge was on the ballot in this primary election. And I think that, you know, that's a very apt description. And he also talked about in his story that, you know, revenge was on the ballot, but it honestly didn't do much to motivate voters anyway.
All right, let's talk about some juicy races that we're going to be focusing on here come November. And I think the big one that a lot of people are talking about, Ted Cruz versus Colin Allred. Your thoughts on this one, guys? Evan?
Oh, I think that Ted Cruz knows he's in trouble. And this is how you can tell. The moment when it became clear that Beto O'Rourke had won the primary, the Cruz campaign dropped an attack ad. That was the first thing they did. They had this whole song and dance number, like literally it was a song about how Beto was a liberal. What Cruz has done, the moment that Allred became the primary winner, he released endorsements from Democrats and saying that, look at me, I'm bipartisan. I've got support. I can work across the aisle, which, by the way, anyone who's watched Ted Cruz's career knows that's BS. That's just silly. That's ridiculous. That's insane. You know, he is a diehard partisan. And so the fact that he feels the need to make himself seem more moderate than he actually has been shows that he knows he's in trouble. That's incredible to me. You know, I'm skeptical about the ability of any Democrat to win statewide in Texas, but this is the sort of moment that makes me raise my eyebrows.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's we're seeing a very interesting shift, right? I think, you know, the 2016, 2020, there was a real kind of like blue wave push for, I think, liberals and especially progressive Democrats. And now we're kind of seeing this kind of return to center almost. You know, Colin Allred is making a campaign off of being bipartisan and being able to kind of work across the aisle and, you know, not being too liberal or too progressive for Texas voters. And I think Ted Cruz realizes that by the tenor of his campaign.
That's going to be an interesting one. I can't wait for that first debate between those two.
Oh, God.
All right, guys, any final thoughts?
I was just happy to see we didn't talk too much about the Republican side. You know, it was a little scary to see three Court of Criminal Appeals judges lose their primaries because they defended the Constitution of the state and said that no, the Attorney General cannot bring criminal charges, cannot run a criminal case unless invited by local DAs. That's pretty clear. And Ken Paxton want to be able to go after people charged with election fraud. And so now, because they stood for the Constitution, these judges have been kicked out. That's a little scary to see. At the same time, I was glad that Jared Woodfill lost his primary challenge to Lacey Hull. So good to see a bad guy go down.
Houston's original neighborhood downtown is for everyone, and it's poppin'. It's our open-hearted home for our biggest celebrations and our treasured hidden gems. From the world-class theater district to incredible green spaces like Discovery Green, downtown is the place to be. In fact, more people visited downtown Houston last year than the entire population of Dallas, Fort Worth, Austin, and San Antonio combined. There's no better time to live downtown than now. From starter apartments to luxury lofts, everyone can take advantage of the arts, business, culture, entertainment, food, and recreation. Now, you might think of downtown as only the heartbeat of Houston's regional economy, which it is, but there's so much more to it, including free events throughout the week with Downtown Houston Plus. From the Market Square Park Farmers Market every Saturday to Yoga Flow every Wednesday, you can find something to do and eat and watch in downtown Houston. Learn more at downtownhouston.org. Downtown Houston, get energized and revived. All right, let's get to our most overlooked stories. I know it was a busy week of election talk. We just spent a lot of time on it. So let's talk about stories that we might have missed. Tim, what do you got?
Yes, so I brought a story from my colleague Miranda Dunlap. She covers suburban education for us at The Landing, and she really did a deep dive into suburban school boards around the Houston area. She focused a lot on how the at-large election model for school boards has, in some cases, produced very interesting makeups for local school boards in the region. She found that in at least three of kind of seven school boards that she really took a deep dive into, that this at-large model has produced results in which school board members tend to live in wealthier or more economically prosperous areas of a district, which then in turn has kind of alienated some lower income students and families who feel as though maybe we need to change this at-large election model. It was super interesting. I think education and education policy is really kind of at the forefront of a lot of conversations. And so really taking a deep dive into who is setting that education policy at a district level is really interesting.
Yeah, this is a fascinating story. I think particularly because I would say I'm always skeptical of having district-specific representatives on school boards because school boards aren't legislatures. You don't elect someone to represent you and vote on bills and do stuff. They're more like a corporate board where their job is to find the CEO, the superintendent, and let them run the show and make sure they're being held accountable to getting the outcomes you want. And when you get people up there on school boards who view their jobs as being you know, direct representatives and legislators, that's where you get in trouble of them trying to direct contracts and make sure that they're micromanaging the principles, so they get the principles people want and do all of this stuff. And that is not how they're supposed to operate. So I'm kind of torn between the sense of, on one hand, you want to make sure that you're really getting good representation. On the other hand, you don't want a school board that's meddling with issues in the same way you don't want a state meddling with these sort of local issues. So I think you have other opportunities out there of how we select representatives, whether it's a mix of at-large and districts, whether it's something like ranked choice voting, multi-member districts. There are a lot of interesting, quirky election systems out there that we could try to implement if the state would let us. But I always like to push back against the idea that we should be switching over to district representation.
Yeah. And her story really kind of gets into the nitty gritty of that, you know, this kind of continued conversation of, if we switch over to single member districts, you know, will that really fix this problem? And it's kind of, it's still a question mark, it seems.
And by the way, all the stories we're talking about are linked in the show notes, including the one by Miranda. So make sure you read it. It is a really good read. Evan, how about you? What was your most overlooked story?
My most overlooked story is that the city and Metro have announced a plan to work together to improve the streetscape on Westheimer from 610 to downtown. This is going to include fixing potholes, repaving streets, but also sidewalk repairs and Metro bus shelters that are part of the Boost program that's supposed to speed up buses so they get there quicker and makes them more appealing. And this whole plan even has the support of Metro skeptic Bill King, who's written about it on his blog. And I have to say, while there is debate about the value of light rail and a proposed bus rapid transit line, I'm really glad to see that everyone recognizes the success of the 82 bus. It is one of the best things that Metro does. It has really high ridership, and we should be investing in making it better and trying to replicate those successes across the system. But one of the things I'm disappointed in about this whole plan is that it's not the Lower Westheimer plan, which had been proposed and debated, that would narrow the street in Lower Westheimer, Montrose neighborhood, down to two lanes, really expand the sidewalks, get some more street parking, dedicated pullover stops for the buses so they don't block traffic, and really turn that whole area into a great walkable neighborhood core. It was proposed to the HGAC, the Houston-Galveston Area Council, which refused to fund it. And that's why we don't have it now. And that sort of thing is what started the Prop B fight to get proportional representation on HGAC in the first place. So without the funding for that, without that moving forward, we end up with sort of a lesser, less ambitious plan. But I'm just glad that folks are working together and that we're trying to make Metro do its job better.
I had not heard about this, so definitely overlooked for me. And as I was kind of reading through the plan, as someone who I live in the Montrose area, I am on Westheimer, both on car and on foot on the sidewalks very often. I was just glad to see that something is being done, because it can be very treacherous, both by vehicle and as a pedestrian. So definitely glad to see that these developments are underway.
Baby steps, right, Evan? Baby steps.
Yeah, just, you know, one thing at a time. I will say, though, that if you're driving on Westheimer a lot, look forward to a ton of construction.
So just another day on Westheimer.
Yeah, how can you tell?
Win some, lose some.
Yeah. Hey, look, there's more construction in the construction zone. I love it. Okay, the most overlooked story for me is this Terminal B plan at Bush, okay? For those of you who don't know, there's this big plan to revamp Terminal B at Bush Airport. It's going to be a massive project that's going to build new gates, new baggage system. There's more amenities, and United is going to be funding some of this. The city's going to be funding some of this. Well, Chris Hollins has made his first big move by blocking the city's funding of $150 million. And it's actually going to be over $600 million throughout the contract or throughout this project. But this is where it gets interesting. All right. So Mayor Turner wanted to get this done before he ended his reign as mayor, and it didn't get done because the last city controller, Chris Brown, also blocked it when Mayor Turner was trying to get it done. And get this. Chris Brown is now part of Mayor Whitmire's team as a senior advisor for financial integrity, and he said that he would not greenlight the funds until the airport system produced an updated feasibility study for the $600 million city bond debt required by the agreement. And now this is going to be like kind of dramatic because the guy who initially blocked it is working on the mayor's team, and the guy who's currently blocking it is like, wait, you blocked it too. So what's going to happen with this big Terminal B project, guys? This is so much drama for a project that I hope eventually gets done.
I'm still trying to figure out entirely what's going on here with this, but it seems like that the controller's office is worried that we can't afford this. Like, we're supposed to pay $624 million as like the city's component of this. And they're saying like, well, we can't afford that money. We don't have this money. And at a time when the city is saying that our budget is unsustainable and we need to make cuts, at the same time, you have an airport budget that has its own funding systems and its own expenditure systems operating over there, cutting these massive, you know, $500 million plus checks.
This whole story is baffling to me. I think Turner had kind of hoped maybe this would be like his piece de resistance, if you will, and it's definitely not shaping up to be that way. But I echo everything that Evan just said. I mean, although I think an updated Terminal B would be great as someone who is frequently flying out of IAH, we all know the city's facing a budget cliff. Like, I don't know how we could afford this. So I think, you know, it's just interesting, right? You have two people who are saying, yes, we can, and no, we can't. So it's like, well, who do we believe, right? I think I need to see the numbers. I need to see the next city budget before we decide.
It's going to be so awkward because, you know, Chris Brown is saying, yes, we can. But you're like, actually, just like 2 months ago, you're saying, no, we can't. So what is happening here?
Yeah, very this much ago. Yeah. What is the truth?
We'll see what happens with that story. And we'll keep you posted. But yeah, the Terminal B drama is fascinating to me. All right, let's get to our moment of joy. Tim, what made you happy this week?
Yes. So I read an article in the Chronicle that NASA graduated 12 new astronauts this week, and they also opened up a call for their next class. And I just think that this, you know, the little kid in me who always wanted to be an astronaut and go to space saw this and thought that was just super cool. You know, I think for a time we were kind of like, not anti-space travel, but there were definitely maybe more pressing issues here on Earth for us to deal with. And now that we're kind of graduating astronauts and focusing more on space travel, it's just kind of it's just cool. It's like, you know, what's out there for us to explore. And, you know, getting to read a little bit about these 12 astronauts and kind of their backstories and just all of the things that they've already accomplished in life and, you know, adding one more notch to their belts was really cool.
It's the best. It's so cool seeing them graduate, and hopefully we find another great class coming up. And every year they open up the applications, I go to it and I'm like, I'm going to apply this year. But you know what? I don't have the educational background. Like, again, I say it every week. It seems like on the podcast, but I think I can knock out the physical requirements. Just can't do the educational one, but it's the best. Evan, how about you? What was your moment of joy?
My moment of joy, you know, we started talking about Tim going to the rodeo. I went to the rodeo this week. I went with my whole family and we had a wonderful time. My kids loved seeing the little newborn chicks at the chicken exhibit. They loved doing the day on the farm where you get a walk through and you get your plants and then you sell them and then you get money to buy snacks at the end. I loved my fried Twinkie, which was delicious. And I have to say, getting there on light rail made it really easy, particularly because we take the kids in a little wagon stroller and we done it last year, and having to park and get that thing out of the car and then walk from the parking lot over to the rodeo was a lot more of a hassle than just parking at Rice University, walking over to the light rail station there in the wagon, getting right on the light rail, and then you're off the light rail, you're at the rodeo. It was excellent.
Yeah, it's so much easier. I went to the rodeo. We talked about it on Tuesday's episode, but it is just a nightmare getting there. And we went at 2 o'clock on a Saturday. Like, it was not supposed to be that busy. Although the concert does start a little bit earlier on the weekends. Mm. The city shutting down roads around the rodeo for whatever reason just makes no sense. Like, it is so frustrating. It was just nonstop, me in the car going, why are these roads shut down right now? Why are they blocking traffic here? It is unbelievable how hard it can be getting just to the parking area. But once you're in there, it's the best. You get to eat all the fried foods. You get to take advantage of all the cool exhibits out there at NRG Center, and then it's fine. So, Tim, you're going to have a blast when you go this weekend.
I'm very excited. I'm very, very excited. And I will also be taking the light rail. So I'm glad to know that it was a smooth experience getting down there.
Okay, we hinted at this. It is finally here. Daylight savings. Our clocks are moving forward, right? Spring forward. Mm-hmm. And I'm just happy because now we're going to be outside a little bit more. But I am regretting this because with a 17-month-old inside the house, the sleep schedule is just going to be a nightmare. Oh. That adjustment's going to be crazy, but it's going to be fine. We'll figure it out. I'm a person who loves to be outside, and being outside right now is the best because the weather's perfect. So my moment of joy, Saturday, I'm going to be outside the entire day. I'm just going to be playing sports. I'm going to enjoy this first big weekend of spring, and I'm going to just take full advantage of it, not only now, but throughout the entire month and all the way into April before it gets a little bit too hot. So that's my moment of joy. We get to enjoy that beautiful weather, that 3 weeks of perfect weather we get here in the city of Houston.
For sure.
Tim, Evan, that was a lot of fun. Thank you so much and have a great weekend.
Thank you. Always love to be here.
Talk to y'all next time.
That was Evan Mintz and Tim Carlin. All of the stories we discussed are linked in our show notes. That will do it for this week here on CityCast Houston. Our producers are Carleon Jones and Joyce Tang. Our newsletter editors are Brooke Lewis and Natalia Aldana. And the host is me, Rahil Ramzanali. Our music is by the band All the Kimonos. We'll be back on Monday with a look at how sex trafficking is impacting teenagers. Thank you for listening, and I hope you learned something new.